Welcome to the Innovation Toolkit Podcast. I'm your guest host, Russ Graves, and today we'll chat with author Dan Ward about his new book called Lift, Innovation Lessons from Flying Machines That Almost Worked and the People Who Nearly Flew Them. Hi, Dan. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
All right. Dan, Lift is your third book. Your first book was titled Fire, How Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained and Elegant Methods Ignite Innovation, which explores how excessive investment of time, money, or complexity actually reduces innovation. And that the secret to innovation is to be fast, inexpensive, simple, and restrained. Your second book digs a little bit deeper into those concepts, especially the term elegance. Titled The Simplicity Cycle, A Field Guide to Making Things Better Without Making Them Worse, you show that unnecessary complexity adds complications. Then provide a number of techniques for identifying the problem and striking the proper balance. Now here's your third book. What made you want to write this book?
Great question. So it's been about 5 years, so part of my question in my head was, could I still do it? Turns out the answer is yes, I still can, so that was fun. But I came across these stories of 19th century flying machines several years ago, and they just completely blew my mind. I really fell in love with the topic. I couldn't stop thinking about these just absolutely bonkers flying machines that people built and launched and crashed in the decades before the Wright brothers came along. And the more research I did into these flying machines from the late 1800s, the more I learned, the more I wanted to share these stories with other people. In large part, that's because most of us know very little about this era of aviation history. Even among aeronautical engineers or pilots and Air Force personnel, there's this weird blind spot. Like we think history began with Orville and Wilbur. And of course, that's not true. There were hundreds of people doing similar work, particularly in the late 1800s. And their stories are amazing on their own. And the best part is they're hugely relevant to the challenges that we face today in the tech world.
So in the book, you found all these stories and you had to shrink them down and you chose 5 stars for your book. In a sentence or less, how would you kind of summarize each of those individuals?
Yeah, it was fun and challenging to narrow this big set of all these inventors to these 5 key individuals, 5 key people who really formed the heart of the book. I picked them because they were all operating before the Wright brothers came along. They all built, designed, launched, and crashed actual hardware, so they weren't just theoreticians, they were experimenters. And finally, they wrote about their experiments. So they actually told the stories because I wanted that first-person, first-hand, primary source for the material about these experiments. So tough question how to summarize each one in a single sentence, but let me give it a try. Chapter 1 is about Octave Chanute. He was a connector who built a community for aviation experiments in the late 1800s at a time when a lot of people were experimenting and nobody was succeeding. Chapter 2 introduces Otto Lilienthal. He's a guy who bravely strapped on homemade wings and jumped off cliffs thousands of times trying to figure out how to make an airplane stable. Alberto Santos Dumont is the core of Chapter 3, and his persistence and his iterative approach to design was a huge inspiration. I want to build my own version of his airship number 9 really, really badly someday. Chapter 4 is about James Means, a Bostonian, who beautifully blended pragmatic realism with this counterintuitive perspective on gravity. He said gravity is what makes flight possible. And he took a really inclusive and invitational posture in his work. And finally, Octave Chanute, the guy from Chapter 1, wrote a perfect summary for the guy in Chapter 5, Lawrence Hargrave. So I'll just quote Chanute. He said, if there is one man more than another who deserves to fly, who deserves to succeed in flying through the air, that man is Lawrence Hargrave. That pretty much says it all about him.
That's amazing stories from each of those individuals. And you added other people that were related to them or part of their story. So it wasn't just those 5 individuals. But as you were doing your research for this book, what was the story that really, really resonated with you or inspired you?
Yeah, I love this question, and thanks for asking it. There's a story I adore that I actually did not include in the book because I just couldn't quite make it fit in, so I'll share it here. It's about a guy named Mouillard who strapped on some homemade wings, kind of like a homemade hang glider sort of thing. He jumped over a drainage ditch out on his farm's back 40, so he's out in the backwoods where nobody could find him, nobody knew where he was, and was absolutely terrified when he found himself gliding along about a foot off the ground, unable to steer, unable to land. He estimated his speed was somewhere between 11 and 8 miles an hour, which puts him somewhere between the top speed of a house mouse and an alligator. Yes, I looked that up. So his flight was scary because he was out in the back 40 of his farm, and he knew that if he crashed, if he got injured, it would be a long time before anyone found him. Fortunately, he did come back to Earth safely. Again, he was literally 1 foot off the ground, traveling at the speed of a mouse. But the coolest part is after he landed, he immediately measured the distance he'd flown between the scuff marks on the ground for where he took off and where he landed again. What an engineer. We all aspire to be an engineer like that guy. Incidentally, he flew 138 feet that day. That is 18 feet farther than the Wright brothers' first flight. So I love that he was so scared. The phrase he used was, oh, the horror, as he found he could not control himself, could not land. And I also love that the first thing he did after landing was measuring the distance he'd covered. But what's really important about the story is that before jumping, he clearly had not anticipated what to do if his wings worked. His design was totally focused on producing lift, with zero mechanism for control. And I think there's probably a lesson in there for all of us as well.
So all these stories are really interesting. And there's another one that wasn't even in the book. These people are willing to strap on some wings, run down a hill, do whatever it takes. Some think through it. And like you said, some think through only half of it. But lifts more than just the stories of some of these men and women you add in there who built flying machines. So your book also tries to provide some practical insights about innovation. What do you want or hope readers take away from your book?
Yeah, I'd say the book is full of stories from history, but it's not really about history. The book is actually about innovation and problem solving. And I think the main lesson is on page 5. On page 5, I say failure is never the whole story, nor is it the end of the story. Of course, I hope people read the rest of the book too, but if you only get up to page 5, at least you'll have something useful from the book. The other big point is the importance of diversity and inclusion and collaboration. There's a really clear pattern across all these experiments and all the modern stories in the book as well. I talk about software, I talk about Ben and Jerry's ice cream, a lot of stuff about superheroes and science fiction all blended in with this as well. And in chapter 3, I really lay out the importance of diversity and inclusion and collaboration when I observe that the people who made the most progress were the collaborators and the bridge builders, the includers and the inviters, the broad-minded generalists and the disciplined blenders. And the people who had the hardest time were the isolated excluders, the narrow-minded specialists, and the arrogant purists. So I think that's a really important lesson that, again, is pretty timeless. That was true in the 1800s. It's true today.
Yeah, perfect lessons. And you talk about cultivating a specific perspective on failure. How do you get organizations or individuals to be more comfortable with failure?
That's a tough question. I don't think anybody ever gets fully comfortable with failure. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with failure. And I think one of the reasons we struggle with dealing with failure is because it so often seems final. But when we understand that failure is not the whole story nor the end of the story, when we see failure as a temporary step or as an unavoidable component of progress, when we see failure as the key to learning, it becomes much more palatable, we get much more comfortable with it. It might even be a little bit fun.
Yeah, so failure is hard. I think I certainly think about failure internally, but don't always want to run around and share it. But what industries or areas do you see where they do share their failures or really look at their failures and try to learn from them well? And which ones not so well?
Yeah, so one of the big themes, one of the big practices that we get from Octave Chanute in chapter 1 is the importance of studying failure. And there are some industries that do that really well. So if someone dies, if a bridge falls down or an airplane crashes, those communities assemble a large group of doctors or civil engineers or pilots to investigate what went wrong and to prevent it from happening again. Those are instances where studying failure can make a really big difference. And medicine in particular does a pretty good job of learning and adapting when things don't work. In contrast, when a software development project goes pear-shaped or a technology development project doesn't work out, we tend to bury that and act as if it never happened. In fact, I was just listening to another podcast talking about Atari in the early 1980s with their E.T. video game. They literally buried thousands of copies of that E.T. video game cartridge in the desert rather than actually study the failure and figure out what went wrong and prevent it from happening again. One of the things my team does, and actually I write about this in the book as well, we have a practice we call a failure cake, mm-hmm. where, no kidding, we get a cake, and on the cake it says, you failed, or something to that effect, you know, congratulations on your failure or celebrating failure. And, you know, it's usually after we've put in a proposal that didn't get selected or we tried something and didn't work out the way we hoped it to. We get the cake, we eat the cake, and we sit around and we talk about what went wrong, what can we learn from it, how can this influence our decisions in the future. And the really cool thing is the cake is always bigger than my team can eat ourselves. So we bring it into the hallway and we share it with other people around us. And they're like, oh, is it somebody's birthday? No, this is a failure cake. Mm-hmm. And we tell the story that way. And again, it's one of those ways to help failure and maybe not be quite so painful and make failure a little more palatable.
Mm-hmm. So Dan, I enjoyed your book immensely.
Thanks.
The history of the pursuit of flight was fascinating. Your writing made me laugh out loud. That's always a good thing. And your lessons are useful and inspiring. I definitely got past page 5 and couldn't put the book down.
Glad to hear it.
But what's the best review you've gotten for your book so far?
I loved that Andy Nullman said Lyft was ebulliently written, even though I always struggle to pronounce the word ebullient. I can't say I was deliberately aiming to write with ebullience, but when I saw that description, I really felt seen, and I knew I wanted to put that on the cover because that's the type of story, that type of approach I was trying to take when we talk about, you know, failure. And a few people have also said the book sounds like me, that it kind of matches the way I am in real life. And gosh, that's one of the nicest things you can say to an author is that the book sounds like them. So that makes me happy. And that is something I very much was aiming to do. I want my writing to sound genuine. And that's not always easy to pull off. So that's a pretty good review as far as I'm concerned.
Anybody out there, haters or trolling on you, your negative reviews? Or anything?
I'm sure they're somewhere. I haven't seen any negative reviews just yet. But if they come, and I'm sure they will, I'm not too worried about those. See, a negative review basically means that I wrote a book. I finished it. I got it published. I took a chance. I sent it out into the world and somebody read it. Mm-hmm. That feels a lot like success to me. I'm not going to frame that as a failure. The finishing, the completion, the sharing. And so if somebody doesn't like the book, well, that person probably wasn't my audience in the first place.
Yes, probably not. Okay, we've talked about the book, and I'm sure listeners here are wondering, where can they purchase a copy of Lyft?
Yeah, so it's not available at Amazon, and that's on purpose. My first two books are. But with this third book, I'm aiming to go a little more local, more small business, more direct, more independent. So you can get the paperback version of Lyft at lulu.com. That's L-U-L-U. The ebook is available at Barnes & Noble or at kobo.com. That's K-O-B-O.com. The audiobook is in the works. We're hoping to have that done by the springtime.
Excellent. You reading it? Or somebody
I'll be
else?
Doing the voice.
You're
I'll be doing the reading voice? For it. Yep.
So it'll sound just like you, like you're talking to us.
That's the plan.
That's the plan. All right. Dan, thanks very much for joining us on this version of Innovation Toolkit Podcast.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much, Russ.
Yeah.